Samurai WTF, stands for Web Testing Framework, honest. It's what we tell people. It's on the website, right? Samurai WTF was written by, or built by, Justin Searle and I originally. Actually, it was originally built by me, and it just was added to the project. I am biased towards Samurai, a little bit. The idea behind it is that it's a live environment. It's a DVD that you can load ISO, that you can load on DVD or into a VM, or load into your machine. And you can do web pen testing. It's got all the tools pre-installed, pre-configured. It's also got a series of test targets that you can go after, right? We use it here in class. Samurai was built because I missed a trip to Vegas. I was supposed to go out to DEF CON 2007. 2008. Had to read the slide. All right. And I was supposed to go to DEF CON. And a client called up the company I worked for at the time, In Guardians, and said, hey, we want Kevin on site this week. And I wasn't able to make it to DEF CON. So we canceled the DEF CON trip. The client then pushed the job. So it wasn't that weekend. It was too late to go get tickets to get out to Vegas reasonably. So I was at home. My wife and kids had left for the weekend because, well, daddy wasn't going to be home. Let's go down and see family, right? So I had a weekend all to myself. So what did I do? I built a Linux distribution. Isn't that what everybody does? Right? So Samurai WTF was built. It's a fun little tool set. When I built it, I built a README that included the username and password, which are, by the way, Samurai, right? And I put that on the desktop. I built the ISO and I uploaded it to SourceForge. About an hour later, I got an email from somebody. Hey, what's the username and password? And I wrote back, it's on the README. They wrote back and said, where's the README? And I said, it's on the desktop. Oh. Yeah, that's a problem. Now, I will say, and I tried to argue this with the guy, that it's a pen testing distribution that you have physical access to. If you're not able to get to the desktop, you shouldn't be using the pen testing distro. He didn't buy that argument. So I told him what it was. In the next release, we put it out on the README out on the website. Took about half an hour before somebody asked me what the password was. So the next release, we put it on the wiki, on the website, and on the desktop. We got asked. So there's actually now a README on the wiki, the desktop, the website, and at the login screen, it says the username and password is Samurai. I still get emails from people regularly asking me what it is. So a good friend of mine, Tim Madin, jerk, set up a website. He's not really a jerk. The website is whatisthesamuraipassword.com. And when you go to it, it says, were you sent here by Kevin or Ed? Because for some reason, that's unknown to me. Ed Skotus gets tons and tons of questions about what is the Samurai password. Now, between us and whoever's listening to the recording, the reason he got so many emails was every single person who asked me, I said, I don't know, Ed does, and gave them his email address. Right? It was something to do, right? I mean, not to be rude, but if it's on the login screen and you still don't do it, it's a snipe hunt, right? So I would send them to Ed, and Ed would send them back to me because he didn't know I was sending them to him. So if you click Kevin on the website, it says Ask Ed. You go back to the front page, click Ed, tells you that it's Samurai. So yeah, Tim still runs that site. So it's been out there for a while. Here's the desktop of it, right? It's split into our methodology. Recon mapping, discovery, exploitation, and the various icons. You also have the terminal to do stuff. It's got a pre-configured wiki. It's got targets to test against and practice with. By the way, when you look at the menu and you've got something like W3AF, which is in recon mapping, discovery, and exploitation, there's no difference in the program, right? Like a lot of people think, okay, I'm in the recon step. I have to run this icon. No. It's a tool that crosses all four steps of the methodology. So it's listed in all four steps of the methodology. Make sense? But it confuses people. And yes, you can use the terminal, it's just an Ubuntu machine. We have given you a copy of Samurai on the DVD. It is the VM that is our attack VM, and we can use it on day 6 for the CTF, right? Now, I want to be very clear here. Very clear. Please, everybody, listen. I'm amazed at how often this comes up as a problem. If the exercise tells you to do something and does not explicitly say, do this over there, it's done in the Samurai VM. Okay? So as you're doing an exercise, if it says, launch Peros, do that in the Samurai VM. Make sense? Okay? And again, both VMs have to be running. Don't forget that when it says, did you copy this or move this, the right answer is, I moved it. Okay? So that's Samurai, pretty simple tool. By the way, the Samurai 1.0 version is being released in April. Right? Finally. We've only been working on it for 10 years. Slight exaggeration. The VM that you guys have, I was asked earlier today what version of Samurai it is, and I said it's the 542 version of Samurai. The reason is, it is an initial build of Samurai 1.0. It is not a complete build of Samurai 1.0, because Samurai 1.0 is not out yet, right? So it is an initial build, just as a heads up. So you guys get it before anybody else does. Isn't that nice? Yeah, well, I wouldn't thank me yet. So, web server architectures. As we look at the web applications we're testing, right, we have to understand the architecture of that server, the application, and how it works. And the idea here is, when we talk about these architectures, right, we're talking about an overall architecture. We're not talking about every single piece. And why we need to care about this is, not because we care, but because it affects our test. If we've got a pure web server and we're attempting SQL injection against it, it's a waste of our time, as we'll explain in the next slide, right? So we want to understand this up front. And now, one easy way to find this out is to ask. As you're getting prepped for the test, either internal or external, say, so, hey, what's the architecture of this application? Give me a diagram. But in a lot of cases, they won't give you a diagram because they want you to hack us like the real attackers do. You been asked that before by a company? I want you to hack me like real attackers. Really? So I get to sell all the credit card numbers I steal when I'm done? I've never actually asked that of a client, but I've wanted to. Right? It's always been one of those things on that, like, oh, this week, no, can't do that. Right? It'll be like a bonus. You steal the data, you give it to them, they pay you for your time, and you make extra money from the criminals. Probably wouldn't stay in business long that way. Or not arrested, you know. So we want to know what this is. So a pure web server, and I'll tell you right now that pure web servers are not found very often anymore. This is a site that cannot do dynamic content. The server is not capable of it. We've either removed the configuration ability, you know, the configurations for it, the libraries for it, or it just never had it, right? We are seeing some growth in this architecture for embedded systems, right? Many of the systems there, I shouldn't say many, but some of the systems there are just running very, very static content for documentation and stuff like that for some of these devices. But the majority of the embedded systems are the next category, right? So when we find these, this is why I say SQL injection is not useful here, right? Because it's a static site. There's no database to attack. There's no dynamicity of the application, right? Yeah, I made up that word too. But I think it's a good word. I think it makes sense, right? The dynamicity of an app, right? This is where most servers fall, the dynamic server architecture. The dynamic server architecture is where you're talking about a site that can be static or, well, dynamic, right? we're able to hit the page, and based on the parameters, based on the request, based on whatever logic they want to do, the website returns different data. This is the majority of the web applications out there today. The vast majority. Almost like the difference between the app store from Apple and BlackBerry App World in number of apps, right? Anybody out here use BlackBerry App World? I got one hand. I have. Right? It's kind of funny how many flashlight apps are in that app world, right? What is it with flashlight apps and mobile phones? Why do you need to buy a flashlight app? Don't you have a web browser you can go to Google and zoom in on it? That's why it's got a white background, so it turns your phone into a flashlight. At least that's what I use it for. Just made me think. Just a few weeks ago, the last time I was home, it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. Power had gone out earlier. We didn't know, right? And the power had been out long enough for the UPSs to die. So when the UPS died, my burglar alarm went off because it couldn't get out to the internet to get to SafeTouch. So the alarm went off, woke us all up. My youngest, Sarah, fell out of bed and hit her head, right? So she's screaming, crying. Brenna woke up and started screaming, "Oh my gosh, I saw the guy go by my room. I saw him, I saw him, I saw him." And my wife and I are like, "Ah," right? So I grab my baseball bat. Of course, power's out, so I can't turn on any lights. So my wife grabs her iPad. So picture this. I'm walking down the hallway with a baseball bat. My wife, who is only 4'11", right? She says 4'11" and a half. She's 2 inches taller than having to use a booster seat while she drives. And she's holding the iPad up over her head so that it goes over my shoulders so that I can see anything because we couldn't find a flashlight walking through the house. It was crazy. But hybrid servers as attackers, right? One, great targets. Why? Because they're simple to set up. You know what that means? They're simple to write code for. So everybody and their brother buys a PHP in 21 seconds book and writes apps and publishes them out there, right? So right off the bat, vulnerability city, right? Yay, woohoo, we're in. The other side of it is that they're so simple to set up and then they'll host 27 billion websites from the same server. All virtually hosted. So if we attack one of them, we've got access to all of them, right? So from an attacker perspective, these are beautiful, beautiful servers. You guys know the rule, right? If a pen tester likes something, get it off your network, right? I love SharePoint. This is another thing that we love, right? When we see servers set up like this, app servers are the next one, right? App servers, WebSphere, Cold Fusion, WebLogic. Is WebLogic even really around anymore? Yeah, right? I haven't seen it in a while, you know, but it's there. The app server, right, from a pen tester perspective, app servers are beautiful. Why? Because you have the beauty of the dynamicity from a hybrid server, but you also have all of the functionality the container, right, provides. So there's usually an administrative console that we can try to access. You know, if we gain access to the admin console, we win, right? There's nothing else we need to do, pretty much. But we also have all of the other things like the UDDI and the web services that are deployed this way many times. We've got the RMI or you know, the performance metric interfaces where we can tie in and grab stuff. I mean, in some containers, you can actually connect to them and insert breakpoints into the running application for debugging, right? Do you really want me inserting breakpoints into your production application's memory? Probably not a good idea for you, right? But the app servers provide these types of things. So we want to look at connecting to that and dealing with that, right? We also have the proxy server. And the proxy servers, this is not an ISA proxy or a proxy 2.0, right? This, or SQUID, typically. We're not talking about the service that prevents your staff from surfing naked people, right? We're talking about a proxy that's designed for load balancing. It's a proxying for all the people coming in, right? All the internet comes through this proxy. Now for us, there's a couple things we want to focus on there, right, as attackers. One, can we get the proxy to go somewhere they didn't mean it to, right? Because it has access to your internal network. Can I get it to surf your intranet pages instead of the pages it was supposed to surf? Also, can I get it to cache my content instead of your content, right? Probably do either of those. Plus, we've got all the stuff from an application server. We've got administrative consoles. We've got, you know, lots and lots of functionality in many of these proxies. And we get to win, right? You guys do realize that our goal is to win as often as possible. That's why Secure Ideas' slogan is professionally evil, right? Yeah, we're professionally evil. We don't do things to be evil. We do things to help you out. Things like attack your proxy server. Right? We want to start focusing on this kind of stuff. And as attackers, we want to understand the architecture before we get too far into the test. We need to understand it because we want to focus our testing on what we can do. Remember, very rarely will you have an organization approach you and say, I want you to do a pen test on my web applications. And you say, how long do I have and what's the budget? And they say, oh, we don't care. Take as long as you need. Spend as much as you need to. And by the way, if you know of any companies that way, call me. But nobody does that, right? They'll give you 2 weeks or 2 hours, right? You can pen test us from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. And the problem is we have to focus our time. That's why we say to people, we're not going to find every flaw in your site. It's impossible. Not in the time frame we have, right? So we've got to be able to make our test as efficient as possible. And the way to make it efficient is to understand the architecture as we go into it, right? So let's talk about the protocol itself. HTTP, so beautiful. Version 1.1 was defined in RFC 2616. Can anybody tell me how I know it was defined in RFC 2616? I'm sorry? It's up on the slide, exactly. It's right there, right? How many people here are staying in the hotel? So many of you, right? So you may have trouble tonight getting to sleep. A lot of people do in hotels because they're new beds, different type of pillow, right? There's noises you've not heard before. Because the person in the room ahead of you, above you, is jumping up and down. That doesn't happen at your house. At least we hope it doesn't. Or maybe we hope it does. I don't know. Right? So if you're having trouble sleeping tonight, my recommendation to you is to read RFC 2616. Out like a light. It's great. Right? I'm sorry? Any RFC for that matter. You're absolutely right, Tim. Any RFC. Right? So HTTP. It's a request response protocol. It does require us to use a reliable transport. As such, I do consider it reliable, right? So we're gonna use something like TCP typically. And when we talk about 1.1, there are tons and tons of changes between 1.0 and 1.1. But out of all of these changes for keep alives and proxies and this and that, we talk about 100 status codes, right? As a pen tester, the biggest change, the most important change for us to figure out is the host header field, right? 1.1 requires the host header field to be set. And when we're manually generating requests, using Netcat, the best tool ever. You guys know that Netcat's the best tool in the world, right? Do you know why we know Netcat is the world's best tool? I'm sorry? Slide doesn't say it. Because Trinity used it in the Matrix. I mean, come on. If it's good enough for Trinity, right? Actually, I just messed that up. She used Nmap in the Matrix. I just totally screwed that up. That's my joke for the Nmap section. Ah! Actually, the reality is she didn't use an Nmap. I'm sorry? You did. So she didn't use Nmap, actually. She walked up to a machine that Nmap had been run on, and then she used SSH brute based on the port scan that had happened. See, and I've got a nod right here. So he knew I screwed it up. Totally screwed that one up. I can't believe it. That was horrible. Right? I'm sorry. I'll live. Oh, I hope so. So here is an example HTTP request. And I want to be very clear here. The HTTP header, which is what this is, ends on a blank line. So I know, I can see it in your eyes. You're saying, but Kevin, there's a lot of damn blank lines up there. That's just for display on the slide, right? If they all got crammed together trying to put down the slide, it'd be very difficult to read, okay? So we put them apart. Do not do that in a real test, right? That would be bad. But if you look up here, right, we've got things like the get request, HTTP 1.1. We've got our host header right here, right, google.com. We've got the cookie, the content length. We've got the user agent. These are all pieces of a request, right? And remember that when we start attacking things, all of these become parameters we can fuzz, parameters we can use, right? I want to talk about the user agent real quick. Ah, the user agent. A string that is designed to tell the application, to tell the server what software the client is using, right? Sadly for them, many developers believe that the user agent is not controllable by the user. They believe that this is an immutable string, part of the web browser. They are fools, right? And as an attacker, we can modify our user agent to break stuff. For example, when the iPhone first came out, there was a website where you could subscribe to read magazines online. And if you bought an iPhone, you got free subscriptions to these magazines. How did they determine that it was an iPhone? The user agent, right? So if you set your user agent to the iPhone string, well, you had free access to magazines. That's a security decision based on a false understanding. That's a bad idea. I've actually seen SQL injection via user agent because they log to a database, right? I've seen command execution via user agent because they log to a file and then they read those files somehow, or the logging is broken. How many people here, and this is, we're about to get up on a rant soapbox. How many people here have seen things like McAfee's Secure scanning system? Used to be called Hacker Safe. Right? Ooh, we'll come in like the super hackers and test your site. And then you get this cool little badge on your website that says, we're safe as of today because McAfee says we are. Woohoo! Right? So when you look at McAfee's documentation, and they just recently changed this. Well, we're talking about still an option, but they've added a second option finally. They require you to turn off your web app firewall for their requests. They require you not to filter their requests because they want to test you as if all of your protections failed, make sure the app is safe, right? Which I can understand the logic and agree with that. So do you know how they tell you to identify their traffic? I'll give you a hint. We're on the user agent slide. According to their public documentation, if you set the string scan alert, all lowercase, in any user agent, the web app firewall is supposed to not filter that request, right? Now they've recently added source IP address as a secondary mechanism for this, but that's a recent change, and all of the people I know that use the service have not been, they were not aware of that change. I only know of the change because I went out and read the documentation, right? So this means if you're ever browsing to a website and they have the HackerSafe logo, I know it's not called that anymore, but it's more fun to say. They've got the HackerSafe logo, you know how to turn off their web app firewall remotely. Isn't that nice? So here's an example of you using a security tool. I'm not telling you not to use that security tool, okay? I'm not saying that. But here is a security tool that is making a recommendation that will make you less secure and then embedding something on your website to let everybody else know that you've made that security decision, right? I bet that's not part of their marketing. I'm just guessing, right? But that's a user agent, right? They've assumed that that user agent can't be changed. I'll bet you that what they assumed was that the public, that documentation wouldn't be public. And then somebody made the decision to make it public. Still a bad decision either way, right? But I know for a fact that the McAfee people understand that people can change the user agent. I know that they know that, right? So these are things that we can play with, right? We can change this, we can modify this. And then as we get the response back, again, the header ends with a blank line, but we've added blank lines here for display purposes, right? So let's look at this. We've got our HTTP 1.1, 200 okay. So the server has basically said, I agree, we will talk HTTP 1.1, and I've done what you asked of me. Right? We've got a success message. We've got, I'm standing in the way. We've got the content type, we've got the character set, we've got the server string. Wow, so they're running Apache 2.2.3. Interesting, right? We've got the timestamp, April 1st, 2011, and the content length. So we have 6K of data, about, in this response, not including the header, right? So let me ask you guys a question. Think like a pen tester, think evil for a second, because we want to adjust your mindset if it's not already there, right? If you're testing a website and the date string, which is the time and date the server thinks it is 2 hours different from yours, what does that mean? I'm sorry? They're set in a different time zone. Either the admins are or the server is, right? Many admins will set the time zone based on where they're located, not the server. Okay, so we know where the admins are sitting, so we can guess when they're off, when they're tired. Do you know the best time to attack a site, in my opinion? I hear end of the day, I heard lunch, 2 o'clock a.m. or p.m.? 2 o'clock p.m., okay. Personally, my favorite time to attack sites, 9:30 a.m. Monday morning, right? People have gotten into the office just long enough to log in, maybe activate some sessions on some things. Then they got up to get coffee and talk about what happened on the weekend. Talk about the amazing race Sunday night, right? Whatever. So they're not looking. And there's a ton of traffic going on, right? So we can blend in. So okay, we did the 2 hour difference. What does it say to me if I look at that time and it's 4.5 minutes different than mine? NTP is set up wrong, right? You have a poor admin because they're not checking their servers to make sure their times are correct. What does that mean? Well, they're probably not monitoring as well. They're probably not patching as well. They're probably not hardening as well, right? Yes, I'm making a lot of assumptions about a set of admins based on a timestamp being wrong, but I will tell you from experience, it's almost always right. When you've got servers that are not syncing with NTP or not doing it correctly, there's other things that are not happening there. There are other controls not in place, and I get to play, right? Maybe it was cached. That's a good point. Maybe we've got a cached response coming from somewhere. That's an excellent idea. So maybe there's a proxy. Maybe there's some type of content distribution network or something like that. Yeah, that could be. Excellent idea. Excellent idea. Right? So we're going to stop here at Origin Server because I just got the flash that said, oh my gosh, it's 10:30. There are bagels and bananas behind the screen. So we're going to stop here. It's 10:30. At 10:50, we'll pick back up. Okay? So do not, just a couple pointers, don't patch the VMs. For some reason, we have people load the VMs up periodically. They change the network settings so they can get on the internet. Don't do that either, not at least not today. And then they patch the VMs. don't patch the VMs. These VMs are set up specifically to be vulnerable to attack. If you patch them, you will remove some of the vulnerabilities we've put into the VMs. Don't do that. The other problem with patching them is we have specific versions of tools on the VM. Sometimes when you patch, you'll patch a library to an incompatible version, and now the tool won't run. So please don't do that either, okay? Just as heads up. Yeah. So let's get started back up with same origin. Now the origin server is part of the protocol. It's the idea of this is the server the content came from, right? And this is mainly used for security. The idea is we want to know where it came from. Why? Because of things like cross-site scripting. We have the same origin policy. Now please understand that this is a JavaScript thing, right? And it's enforced by the browser, so your client can decide not to enforce it. That would be dumb, but it could do it, right? The idea of same origin is that this is the server it came from. The host, the port, and the protocol is what sets what the same server is. And it prevents a script from server one from accessing the response from server two. Notice I said accessing the response. I didn't say anything about sending a request. Same origin does not block the sending of a request. It only blocks the receiving of the response, right? Which is how Google Analytics work, right? You insert Google Analytics on your page, and the same origin is based on where the page that has the script tag is located. So like secureideas.net uses Google Analytics. If you go to www.secureideas.net, you're going to get a page that has a script tag that loads code from analytics.google.com. The same origin of that script is www.secureideas.net, because that's where the script tag was loaded from. Doesn't matter that that script tag referenced a different server. Make sense? We base that to prevent some script on Ed's evil server from accessing the bank, right? You don't want to have somebody just go out to a website, pull down code, and have that code be able to call and retrieve the response from your bank. Make sense? So let's look at how that's affecting things. So if we have a browser fetching a script from www.sec542.org about info.php, right? If we look at this table, the first two options here are allowed, right? Because they're the same protocol, host, and port. This third one will be rejected because the port changes to 8181, right? This one will be rejected because it goes to HTTPS. This one will be rejected because it goes to web dot instead of www dot. Different host. This one throws off a lot of developers. So sec542.org points to the same server as www.sec542.org, right? But according to your browser, it's a different server because the host name has changed. Right? A lot of developers get thrown off by that. Now let me ask you guys a question. We're gonna do a poll of the audience. If I have http://www.sec542.org/whatever, and the JavaScript that comes back attempts to access http://www.sec542.org:80. Which is the default port for HTTP, right? Would that violate same origin or be allowed? Does anybody say it would be violating same origin? You do. Anybody? Good answer. It depends on the implementation of the browser. Some browsers treat it as same origin. Some browsers treat it as different. Can anybody tell me which way Firefox does? Don't think too hard about it. The reason I say don't think too hard about it is because it's a bit different based on different versions. The sad part is, I can't tell you that Firefox 3 does it one way and Firefox 12 does it another way. Because different patches have changed it. For example, IE7 with this patch treats it one way, and IE7 with that patch treats it a completely different way. Isn't that beautiful? And of course, we're now up to what? Firefox 96? Yeah, what the hell is that? Right? We want bigger version numbers. Firefox 4,876. And when you ask them about it, they say it's easier for the users. No, it's not. Pet peeve of mine. So why do we care? Well, about this, not about Firefox's random crappy version numbers. The reason we care about this with the colon 80 is a number of our tools, Dirtbuster pops to mind immediately. If you right click and say copy URL, the URL you copy actually says colon 80, right? And when you click that link, let's say you send that link to a client, the client clicks the link, but your JavaScript doesn't have the colon 80 on it. Well, guess what? You now don't have a working exploit. And your client is going to say, whoa, this didn't work. This is bad. Thank you. So keep that in mind as you're testing stuff, right? As you're looking around at stuff. The next thing we want to talk about are URIs. Uniform resource indicators. Now, I want to just let you know right now that many people, and we won't name any names to embarrass them, but Kevin Johnson would be one of them. Me, in case you're wondering, right? We'll use the term URL interchangeably with URI. Semantically, that is incorrect. I'm an idiot, right? But come on. We all know I'm an idiot. Deal, please. We'll have the same problem when we talk about SSL and TLS. We use those interchangeably. You'll hear me say, oh, just use SSL. I mean TLS. You're supposed to do the translation in your head, right? Do what I say, not what I say. It's always the problem with this kind of stuff. You know, it's like the whole thing about acronyms. Do you say them or spell them? Like anybody use Sizzle? You know Sizzle, right? SSL. I had a whole, what? Weepy. I had a guy, he always used to talk about the TCPIP settings of the mainframe. And I didn't know what TCPIP was, because I'm like, well, it must be a mainframe thing. You know, those mainframe big black boxes, you send traffic to them, responses come back. If they don't, you call some gray-haired guy. Look, I got gray hair, okay? I'm allowed to say it. I'm old. My daughter said to me last night, went into the pool. My daughter said to me, Daddy, you have gray hair everywhere. Like, thanks. All right? Love you too, honey. So the guy kept talking about the TCPIP settings. TCPIP this, TCPIP that. Finally, one day, I put in a change ticket for something. He talked about the TCPIP settings on my server. I raised my hand. Like, I'm sorry, we don't have TCPIP. That's a mainframe thing. That's when I found out he was saying TCP/IP, which, by the way, my server did have. That's not a mainframe thing, in case you're wondering, right? So URIs are how we reference a resource, right? We've got the protocol, the optional username and password, the host and domain, an optional port, then the resource, and then optional parameter equal value, right? Now, as we start looking at these things, well, it's kind of interesting, and that's cool. So we've got stuff like ID equals 42, best number ever, right? I was so excited when they told me my class was gonna be 542. Yes. Don't forget your towel. But if you start looking at things, what about this? index.php/id/42/name/Kevin. Now that looks like that's a series of directories, right? Finally ending in a resource called Kevin. But the reality is, this is a server using a technology similar to, or exactly, mod rewrite. And it's rewriting the URL. And it's taking those resources and converting them to parameters and then passing it into the application. The application's processing that correctly. Why would they do that? Can anybody tell me? Bookmarks? That's correct. Search engine optimization is exactly right. Because most search engines will not affect page rank based on parameters, but will based on directories and file names. So for search engine optimization, you can do this. Now, as the attacker, because to be honest, I don't care about search engine optimization except for the Secure Ideas website and Sans, right? But as an attacker, Mod Rewrite has had vulnerabilities in it. Mod Rewrite has had capabilities for us to bypass access restrictions because of faults in how it rewrote the URL. So by looking at the URL format, I already know the potential for attack. Ooh, it's kind of cool, right? We also have things like this, right? ID equals 42, dollar sign name equals Kevin. That's probably parsed by server-side code. So we have the potential to inject server-side code into this request, potentially. Or we've got something like this, param equals ID colon 42 and param equals name colon Kevin. Most of the time I've seen that format, I know that it's taking those two parameters and passing it to a command line tool, like a script or an executable. So what happens if I change my name colon Kevin to name colon Kevin semicolon RM minus RF slash? Right? That would work, potentially. Suck for the people running that server, right? And then we've got the various HTTP request methods. Ah, the request methods. So let's start with get, post, and head. Request methods are the verbs of the internet, or something like that. So a get, very simple request, right? All the parameters are passed via the URL. As an attacker, if we see a get, well, we know a couple things, right? One, well, it's pretty easy to fiddle with those parameters. Two, it's commonly used for bookmarking, right? When I bookmark something, all the parameters being there is nice. Three, it's easier for me to deliver my exploits to somebody else, right? Because I can just take the entire link and hand it to somebody else. They click it, it works. So it makes cross-site scripting attacks or things like that easier to pull off. Post, everything's in the payload, or, well, supposed to be. I actually see a number of applications that, even though it uses post, put things in the get payload also. So don't lose sight of that, because most of the automated tools will see that it's a post and ignore parameters on the URL. That's bad. They're going to miss vulnerabilities, right? So we want to look at post, right? It's still able to be manipulated. One of the things I like about seeing post parameters is that most developers think that people can't manipulate that. Well, it's part of the post payload. You can't change that. Yes, yes, I can. Right? So, yeah, like, aren't you a little old to be aren't you a little young to be attacking these websites? Yes. Why? Yes. Yes, we are. Right? The head method is interesting. It does the same request as get or post, based on whether you're in the payload or in the URL, but it tells the server only return the header. This is kind of nice for us attackers, right? Because if we can do head method requests and the information we want is in the header, they work faster. They're more efficient, less bandwidth, right? And those zeros and ones, we need to conserve, right? At least recycle them, I don't know. Yeah. So if we can do a head request to see if the page exists, if we get a 200, it does, then let's make the request. If we get a 404, move on, right?